My name is Dario Hasenstab. I'm here with Walter Hagritz, and we're back with the Western Bubble podcast. Today, we're talking about individual responsibility. Hi, Walter. Why are we talking about this topic today? What fight did we have in the last 2 weeks that we now have to talk about individual responsibility?
Yeah, unfortunately, it wasn't much of a big fight. I think listeners are still waiting for the moment that we are really breaking out into a huge disagreement on our podcast. I think a common criticism is that we agree too much. But in last week's episode, we came to a moment where we talked about voters and the behavior of people when it comes to war and international relations. And you made the case that they don't really know much better, that you can't expect them to be responsible for the decisions that policymakers implement. And I made the case that we should absolutely hold voters responsible and individuals in general responsible for the way that they facilitate war, they facilitate bad policymaking, they facilitate the rise of populism. And so we thought, hey, that would be an interesting conversation to have. To what extent do we take voters seriously or not?
And what are the facts?
According to Ron Haskins, personal responsibility is the willingness to both accept the importance of standards that society establishes for individual behavior and to make strenuous personal efforts to live by those standards. By personal responsibility, we also mean that when individuals fail to meet expected standards, they do not look around for some factor outside themselves to blame. The demise of personal responsibility occurs when individuals blame their family, their peers, their economic circumstances, or their society for their own failure to meet standards. Personal responsibility should be an individual accepting that they have an obligation towards themselves and the surroundings to make informed and careful and constructive decisions.
What is the bubble?
So when we're talking about individual responsibility, the origin of kind of that discussion is, why is everyone allowed to vote in today's society? I mean, if it was just a selected few men that we maybe call citizens, then there would be individual responsibility on them, but not on everyone in society. And not everyone has to, I don't know, think about the in and outs of the socioeconomic state of the world.
Yeah, this has been a common conversation ever since the beginning of these democratic ideals. You can take it all the way back to Plato in ancient Greece. This conversation about, democracy should be people deciding on their leadership. However, can people make those informed decisions or not? And so people like Plato, they came up with ideas such as philosopher kings. Now you need some kind of elite group of hyper-intelligent, hyper-knowledgeable people who create the best of both worlds, right? On the one hand, you still have accountability of the system because you've got these intellectuals making sure that everything runs well, while at the same time getting rid of, if you like, the ignorant masses that cannot make informed decisions. Unfortunately, the problem there is that once you go down that route, you create a small group of philosopher kings that decide everything. Corruption will in fact take place, and you don't have the accountability that you would see in a more egalitarian democratic society.
I remember that during my high school exchange in the United States, I once caused a huge roar basically across campus when I proposed exactly that. And I said, well, maybe we should limit the people who are voting by, I don't know, income, IQ, right? I was very young. I had no idea what IQ was. Maybe by education levels in general, or any other factors such as age. We should restrict old people from voting. They make terrible decisions anyways. But as you said, right, it's very difficult to define then, okay, what are exactly the lines, right? Is an IQ test a good test? Won't an IQ test be inherently basically flawed in determining who gets to vote and not? Because, I mean, if you look at some of those people in the high IQ club, those are usually weirdos that I'm not sure whether I would be comfortable with them making decisions for us.
Well, yeah, so there are these two angles that both of them lead to the conclusion that probably the least bad option is to let everyone, at least every adult, vote, right? So theoretically, even if we were able to create tests that were kind of fair and representative of society and it would fulfill the criterion of people with sufficient levels of intelligence making choices, even then, having such a small group of people being in such a powerful position leads to really bad outcomes. It leads to corruption. It leads to sort of internal tribal thinking. I mean, right now you can see how the US Supreme Court is struggling with serious ethical questions, because basically you have a bunch of people that are unaccountable to the masses for too long and therefore starting to behave badly. So that is a serious problem in that theoretical framework. Now, in practice, exactly as you're saying, there is a real issue with, okay, how would you even make that work? What criteria are you going to use? Almost always, or always, when you come up with some kind of possible solution, you will find that that solution is either racist, or it's elitist, or it's sexist. It doesn't fulfill the criteria that you are requiring for this kind of system.
See, it's almost like you are trying to give the listeners a hint towards one of the next episodes when you're talking about the US Supreme Court, because that is indeed on our list for the next episodes. However, the consequence of what you just outlined is that if we can't restrict anyone from voting because they would be racist, sexist, any of the other isms, the consequences of this is that everyone gets to vote. And with this also basically your idiot neighbor, right? The one who you really don't like, you once had dinner with them and you realize that he really doesn't know what he's talking about, and he gets to vote who runs this country. Oh no, Boulder. What do we do now? Because idiots tend to make destructive decisions, particularly for themselves.
Well, this puts us in danger of going down the route of, what is it? Like 80% of people believe that they're an above average driver, right? So the danger here is that we are talking about others as if they shouldn't be voting. But hang on, why should we be voting, right? You and I also have certain biases and certain weaknesses. I don't think the question is really about whether idiots vote or not. The question is, do people have sufficient knowledge and awareness and personal responsibility, as you discussed in the fact sheet, to actually make a informed and constructive decision? And there, the answer does not have to be directly correlated to people being ignorant or idiots. It can just be because people don't have time to think about it. They've got other things in their lives, and therefore they go with their intuition when it comes to voting, or they go with their intuition when it comes to war and peace and those big policy decisions. And that's what makes it dangerous. Not so much is someone, you know, less intelligent than the next person.
Right. Thank you very much for basically making my argument from the last episode, right? Because that's why I always defend, and I don't know, I might go down in one of the biggest defenders of Trump voters. Because I always feel like that they're having really bad press is because they are the ones who were basically left behind by the system, right? And now they're rallying up against that system, and there's no other alternative than Donald Trump. So they kind of choose for that, and they might not be aware, might not be capable, or might be so frustrated that they do not realize that Trump then actually passed policies that are hurting exactly them, right? And same with Brexit, right? You brought up Brexit. Is that the British voters were voting on a matter that I'm not sure anyone or everyone truly understood how devastating that would be for the British economy and for the average voter. And right, so here you have, that's basically my entire case, right? Is that you can't really be mad at people for making a decision out of whatever triggers them for something that they believe, right, that might finally change my personal circumstances, or this will reverse some of these effects that have kind of turned my life the wrong way.
Yeah, I fully share the problem that you observe when it comes to the way that media deals with Trump voters. I've said this in the past as well. It's been very frustrating to observe liberal media, and if you like, the intellectual classes, continuously sort of get entertainment out of showing that Trump voters are idiots, right? And of course, that is first of all, incorrect analysis. You're not telling me that 75 million Americans are all idiots, and you're not telling me that they are not good people. You know, so there I completely agree. It can't be a conversation about that, because that is just purely tribal. That's as if you're a left-wing liberal, then you're on the right side of history, and if you're a conservative, then you're on the wrong side of history. No, that's not how this goes. Where I think the difference comes in, and Brexit is a really good example for that, between you and me, is that I'm not interested in moral judgment. I'm not interested in saying you're evil for voting for Trump, or you are morally wrong or reprehensible for voting for Trump or voting for Brexit. What I don't accept is this idea that because people don't have sufficient awareness or knowledge about the decisions that they're making, that they should be let off the hook, because that way you basically reduce accountability within the system. You need to point out that the people who voted for Brexit are responsible for the destruction that's taken place. The people voting for Donald Trump are responsible for a lot of the really bad policymaking and the kind of collapse of institutional responsibility within American society and all that is taking place. They have to take responsibility. They have to be held accountable so that the system still works. So I don't disagree with you on the fact that they're not, you and I completely agree that they're not idiots and that they're not reprehensible human beings. But what I do think is that we have to call them out on this. You voted for this. You made this happen. Learn from that. Don't let that happen again, please.
Okay, so because my next question was going to be, so what's the consequence, right? I mean, if there has to be consequence to individual behavior, then, okay, telling them learn from it, because, I mean, we can't really say, oh, next election, you don't get to vote, right? We're going to select you and you basically get eliminated from the voting registry because you once made a bad call. I mean, what's the consequence here? Is the consequence either, oh, I have to do better next time, I have to be more informed, and how do you assure that? Or is the consequence then maybe even, I made a bad call, maybe I shouldn't go vote again because I have a bad track record of voting. On that line, I shouldn't make any foreign policy predictions because I've been wrong too many times.
But I've been wrong many times as well, and that is not a problem as long as I'm open to me being wrong about it. So the consequence starts with the freedom that we should be given to criticize voters, right? It sometimes seems as if there's some kind of taboo about, oh, no, don't touch voters. Voters are always right. Or, no, they're just innocent in all of this. They are being manipulated by the elites. They didn't really understand Brexit. It was the elites who lied to them, so we should be critical of the elites. No, I take human beings seriously. And all those voters who maybe have been manipulated could have read up on it. They could have thought about it more carefully. They could have gone with something other than their gut instinct. And when they don't, when they didn't, we should be entitled to criticize them. Go after them, say, this is where you went wrong. You voted for Brexit. Now you're facing the consequences. Please accept that responsibility. That's the first step. Now, the long-term consequences are, of course, not much more than that, simply because you can't have a system where if someone makes a mistake, they get thrown out. That's not how it works. That would undermine the entire democratic process. So they have a legal right to continue to be wrong, but we should be calling them out on that, right? We should be pointing out where they did go wrong and how. And before maybe listeners are a little bit, you know, confused about what I mean with the word wrong, I don't mean wrong in the sense of disagreeing with Balder, right? I have certain political perspectives. It's perfectly acceptable for someone to vote in a different direction because they emphasize different things. It's not about everyone who doesn't vote for the party that I vote for is wrong and should be criticized. No, absolutely not. Wrong here I define as in being destructive to their own ambitions and their own ideals, right? So your average American voter who wants to vote for Donald Trump believes in the United States, but hasn't really thought through what makes the United States potentially a well-functioning, pleasant, good society. The answer to that is respect for democratic liberal institutions. Without that, the United States collapses. The moment you vote for Donald Trump, you are undermining the country that you admire, the country that you worship. And that's when you're wrong. You're basically doing something that goes against your own long-term interests.
See, this reminds me of my U.S. government teacher in high school, Holly Karchner, who said that everyone who votes different from me is an idiot. And with this, I'm obviously trying to lead over to the next part, because you said just a few minutes ago that 75 million Americans can't be all idiots. Then on the other hand, I find here a very nice survey, a very nice poll, I might add, from 2019, right, where a researcher asked 3,200 Americans, should Americans, as a part of their school curriculum, learn Arabic numerals? And some 56% of the respondents said no, while 15% said they had no opinion. So my question to you now, Balders, what's wrong with these terrorist numerals, basically, right? I mean, why don't we want to use them? But on the other hand, what do we prefer here? Do we prefer people to say yes or no, or to say, I don't know?
Well, so 100% no opinion, right? If you say, I do not know, then you're basically acknowledging, you're being aware of your own ignorance on this topic. You could ask, hey, what do you mean exactly by Arabic numerals? All right. And then hopefully the explanation will be, hey, those are the numbers that you're already using. But I think that is an absolutely acceptable answer. I do not know is very often the best answer you can give to something. The problem is those 56% who seem to have a strong opinion without actually understanding the question, without understanding what they're talking about. And that's where it goes wrong. So that can be absolutely applied to Trump or to Brexit or to right-wing populism, as in destructive populism in Europe at the moment. I could apply it to the war, the war in Iraq. I could apply it to immigration, all kinds of things where people basically take a very clear position rather than saying, I'm sorry, I don't have time to study this. I just don't know the answer. I hope other people who know more than I do will make the right decisions. You know, so it would be the same as me asking, hey, Balder, do you think that string theory is a legitimate school of thought in theoretical physics and quantum mechanics? If I were to express anything other than I don't know, then I am being deluded about my value in this conversation. I have no idea about theoretical physics, and I have no idea about string theory, so I defer to experts. That's what you want people to do when it comes to voting, when it comes to policy making as well.
Yeah, but isn't that the problem? That because you not only get asked about string theory and Arabic numerals, you also get asked about the economy, about, I don't know, social progress, about foreign policy, about, state lines, about infrastructure, about voting rights, about all these things. I can comfortably make a semi-educated statement on maybe 2.5 of those areas that I've just read out. And now I'm supposed to be able to basically be informed enough to determine which of the experts or representatives that I'm voting for will most likely have the most educated guess on all of this, right? That's where I struggle with kind of seeing individual responsibility with the voters, because I can do that for foreign policy. I can't do that for the environment, for example.
No, so here's the problem, right? You're being asked to vote for one political leader in presidential elections or one political party in parliamentarian elections. And basically, you obviously cannot evaluate every single policy decision that they have and then, you know, come up with some kind of conclusion like, I agree with 30 out of the 55 policy positions, therefore I'm going to vote for this guy. That's not how it works. What you need to do is you need to defer to the experts and say, hey, who are the experts saying that is the right person given my ideological belief system? So if you are evangelical, it's perfectly okay to use your religious beliefs to inform your voting. But you cannot, so you cannot then just stick there and say, hey, the only thing I'm going to listen to is my pastor. And if my pastor says vote Trump, then that's it. No, I also have to read up a little bit on what do economic experts say on Trump's plans versus Biden plans. What do health experts say on COVID or vaccination? You read up a little bit. That takes a couple of hours, maybe half a day of work once every 4 years, in what experts tell you that you should care about. And then you follow those experts. And if you don't do that, then that's the moment that you don't take your personal responsibility. If you could find me economic experts who tell you that Donald Trump's or Brexit policies are the right policies for the country, then I will send you, you know, €1,000, because they don't exist, not the real expert. There's no economist in the world that seriously suggests that Brexit has been good for Britain. It just doesn't exist. So the moment you vote for Brexit is the moment that you declined to actually do a couple of hours of research into what people are saying about this.
Yeah, but what if the expert from CNN tells me Trump is terrible and evil, and the expert from Fox News tells me that Trump is the next savior and he will save us? I mean, now I have two basically competing experts, and I'm in the middle, in between, and I have to decide. Yeah, you know, that expert, that woman, you know, she sounds smarter than the man, so might as well stick with her.
So this is one of the problems of the media, right? That the media always try to sort of cover both sides, even in cases when there aren't both sides. Now, the obvious answer to your question or to your comment is don't follow CNN or Fox News, because they are not reliable news. There's plenty of information out there about what experts say on specific topics. Now, what you will find is that there are indeed differences between experts. And that's how you could reasonably vote for, if you look at Germany, the Christian Democrats, or you could vote for the socialists. And because there are experts on both sides who argue that that there are arguments to be made there. That's perfectly fine. So not all the expert analysis leads to the same result. But it does insulate you against destructive populist behavior. It does insulate you against voting for Brexit. There was no serious economist who said Brexit's going to be great news for the United Kingdom. There was no serious economist who said, oh yeah, Donald Trump's economic plans are brilliant. So there is only one reasonable choice to make. If it is about subtle differences between political parties, slightly right or slightly left, you know, you just follow the experts that you feel intuitively most comfortable with.
But instead of going through the effort of finding a news outlet that is somewhat in the center and gives me experts from both sides, and then I listen to these experts from both sides on each of the topics for a few hours and so on, instead of that, we usually vote on different things, right? On kind of what triggers us. So it's, I don't know, there's good and evil, and I'm with the good ones because that makes me feel good, right? So we see this on a daily basis. We see this, for example, with foreign policy, right? And that's obviously the aspect that we understand most about. So let's focus on this, because here we then have a basically people voting along the lines of, oh, who do we think are the enemies? Who do we think is the danger? And who protects us against these?
Yeah, absolutely. You have got this tribal insider-outsider dynamic that is incredibly powerful intuitively, right? So the moment you say there's an evil dictator somewhere in the world who is out to get us, then you are going to feel intuitively very comfortable with the idea that politicians say we have to go after him. We have to strike first. Iran is about to get nuclear weapons. We need to deal with Iran right now. We have to boycott Iran. China is an authoritarian evil system that oppresses the Uyghurs. Okay, straight away, we need to do something about it. That intuitively, certainly in foreign policy, we have a tendency towards, if you like, jingoism, belligerence, aggressive behavior towards the outside world. Even though we don't have sufficient information to make that assessment, The proper answer should be, hey, I don't know about Iran, I don't know about China, so don't ask me about it, ask an expert. But instead, people say, oh yeah, no, absolutely, because my country is great, that other country sounds horrible, let's attack them. And that's exactly what leads to those horrible foreign policy adventures that you've seen over the past 25 years.
So here I'm, now I have to kind of drill down on this again, because I'm still not convinced. Because particularly with these topics, there are very serious experts out there who then tell me, oh, Iran, those are the bad guys, we need to bomb them, right? I mean, you have those experts, and then to make it matters worse, the establishment, right, those parties at the center that I should kind of follow the experts' advice on who in the establishment should I vote for, they are the ones who have been doing this terrible policy.
No, that's absolutely fair. So we kind of moved on, or at least I moved on in the analysis about behavior, about how foreign policy can thrive off the ignorance of voters, right? Because voters or people feel that they intuitively understand something, even though in reality they're completely ignorant on the topic. They're ignorant on Iran, they're ignorant on China. However, you're absolutely right. In terms of foreign policy, there are differences. And I should point out that George W. Bush in 2000, when he was voted in, he became president in 2001, when he was voted in, he was seen as a relatively moderate candidate, you know, and there was no shame in voting for George W. Bush. So there the criticism is not about the voting patterns of people voting for George W. Bush. Well, let me put it like this. Voting for George W. Bush in 2000 was not a shameful thing to do. In terms of foreign policy, in 2004, I would have some more concerns about that, because then it became clear that the destruction of Afghanistan and Iraq and the war on terror in general had taken place. So, but there the criticism is, now in a democratic society where politicians are in power, not populists or not extremists, but mainstream politicians, they're going to be pushed towards extremist policy decisions. They're going to listen to the experts who are actually more belligerent, more jingoistic, because that is where the average voter feels intuitively comfortable, right? So basically, before the conversation was about who to vote for, please don't vote for destructive populists. Now it is more about how do politicians who are in power use the belligerence of voters in terms of foreign policy.
And this is where I think I'm happy to agree with you, right? Is so you voted for Trump in 2016. That's okay, right? Because of all the reasons I mentioned earlier. You then witnessed Trump for 4 years, including all the little scandals, including all the decisions, including the insurrection, right? All of that. Now voting for him again in 2024, that is basically a lack of personal responsibility.
Yeah, there would be an extreme version. I mean, again, I would question whether voting for him in 2016, it was the right. I would criticize that decision, right? Not because you're an idiot for voting for him, but simply because, like I said, there were very few experts who actually said, hey, Donald Trump is right about this. There was very little reason to believe that Donald Trump had a serious plan for the United States. There was very little reason to believe that Donald Trump would actually implement good policies. People voted for Donald Trump because they somehow were angry with the establishment. They were angry with the Hillary Clintons, and they wanted to basically, you know, give them the middle finger. And voting Donald Trump seemed like a good way to do that. I criticize that kind of behavior, and I think we should be allowed to criticize it. Obviously, voting now in 2024 for Donald Trump would be an extreme version of that misstep, right? Because now you've seen the problems that Donald Trump creates for the entire country, the foundations of the country that you believe in as an American. If you're generally flying the American flag in your garden because you believe that your country is somehow special, then you cannot vote for Donald Trump, because Donald Trump is undermining that entire system that was set up by the founding fathers in the 18th century.
What's the international relations context?
Let's take a step back. And when I say a step back, right, I mean, let's actually look at the bigger picture, which is what we like to do in this segment. with basically the, I mean, let's call it the decline of personal responsibility or the lack of personal responsibility amongst voters when it comes to these foreign policy decisions, or I mean, in general decisions, right, made by Western politicians. What we see, and we've been observing this for 80-something episodes by now, is basically a decline of the Western model, a decline of liberal democracy, and a decline of institutions. When we are now looking at the international relations perspective, that entire democracy with the personal responsibility doesn't really seem to be working out for the West.
So that's why this conversation, this episode, fits so nicely into this whole Western bubble series, because the rest of the world is looking at the decline of this model, the inability of voters to take responsibility in a constructive way, instead voters turning to extremist populism, destructive populism, and as a result the rest of the world looks at it and says, hey, you know what, I don't want my country to fall into this trap, I don't want my country to follow this path. You notice more and more resistance against liberal democracy in sub-Saharan Africa, for example. You notice much more questioning of liberal values in Central and Latin America, with Bukele now being the poster boy for how to do things, or even Milei to a certain extent, being like an anti-democratic, anti-liberal symbol. So the problem is that the rest of the world is not convinced by how the model works anymore. And therefore, the West has lost this narrative, right? Whereas previously they could say, oh, we are the vanguard of where you're all going to go. Now people say, no, I'm looking at what you're doing over there. No, thank you very much. I'd rather do my own thing. I prefer stability. I prefer a Chinese model, or if you like, a Hindu nationalist model in India, where there is clarity, where we know where we're going, and we don't leave everything up to your average voter, because the average voter cannot be trusted.
For context, right, Bukele is the president of El Salvador, who basically locked up close to 50,000 gang members. Apparently, at least 5,000 of them were innocent, right? But he, in that sense, solved the extreme violence in El Salvador, obviously kind of establishing a nature of extreme crackdowns, celebrated by some in the West, right? And then you have Milei, who kind of did the same, right? Where, well, not the same with the violence, but basically was very extreme on his economic approach, basically sending over half of Argentinians into poverty.
And it's particularly interesting in the case of Bukele that that is an absolute rejection of liberalism, right? Because whether you like it or not, by locking up potentially 5,000 innocent people as part of a bigger group, he did create stability that people are facing. But liberalism says there's literally this expression, it's better to have 10 guilty people walking outside than one innocent person being in prison, right? The moment that you're willing to sacrifice the innocent individual for the greater good is the moment that you've lost the liberal democratic narrative and that you're doing something else. And that's exactly what the rest of the world is moving towards, saying, we don't buy into this hyper-individualism where the individual rights should be protected at all costs. If infringing on individual rights for the sake of the greater good of society actually has a productive outcome, then that's what we will do. And so that is absolutely a rejection of that Western model built up over hundreds of years.
And can you explain to our listeners what is the problem?
And that's a problem, right? Because, I mean, well, to be honest, internationally, I'm going to leave each Westphalian entity to kind of to decide whether that's a problem for them or not. But I can be the judge of that for the West, at least for Germany and some other countries that I've lived in. And that's a problem. Like, that's incredibly damaging, is the fact that because of the lack of individual responsibility, again, I still kind of disagree on where we... Like, who do we blame more, or who gets the majority of the blame? But we are basically weakening the liberal democratic model, and we're kind of exposing the weaknesses within the system by continuously rejecting that personal responsibility.
Well, absolutely. It's this podcast would not be possible in China. This podcast would probably in the future not be possible in El Salvador if things continue as they are. And that is a problem for people who actually believe in this kind of liberalism. We believe in this liberalism, and so the collapse of the system, the, you know, dreaming of a world where everything is liberal democratic is painful to watch for us. But I completely share what you're saying about this is something that each Westphalian society, each Westphalian state needs to decide for themselves. What do they value? I, as a child of Christian enlightenment, if you like, at least I'm not a Christian, but that culture, certainly still would like to fight for the liberal democratic values of my society. But I completely understand that people around the world say, no, thank you. That's not a fight. I want to fight. I care about other things. I want the freedom from being killed by drug gangs. And that therefore I want an authoritarian system, or I want economic prosperity as provided to me by the Chinese government. And I'm very happy to give up the freedom to record any podcast I like in exchange for that. So I, you know, it's absolutely legitimate for the rest of the world to look at Europe, to look at North America and say, poof, no thank you, we'll go in a different direction. But I still haven't given up hope, right, for our own society.
I mean, but it is also absolutely legitimate for us to ask that question, right? I mean, because that's one of those things where, I mean, I was always surprised how even at university, questioning the legitimacy of democracy or the usefulness of democracy for us isn't really a thing you can do, right? And that's, I mean, that kind of goes back to the conversation we had earlier in the bubble section when I said, well, for me, it has always been a no-brainer. People need to go vote no matter what they vote for, but it's better for them to go vote. And you said, well, I'm not so sure about that, right? Because, I mean, you better not vote instead of making a terrible decision that will have destructive consequences on your personal life.
Yeah, I think we had this conversation in preparation to this episode. I think our listeners haven't listened to it yet. But that's exactly right. So one of the worst things that you can do if you believe in the system is not to criticize it, right? That's exactly the reason why we have this whole podcast thing. Because we believe in liberal democracy for us, not for the entire world. Everyone has to make up their own mind. But for German society, Spanish society, Dutch society, we would like this. We believe it's a good thing and we would like it to continue. That's why we are heavily criticizing it. And you're absolutely right. There's a taboo in our society about criticizing or critically thinking about whether democracy is actually the way forward or not. And that goes also back to the conversation that we had previously about whether to blame voters or not. There is this taboo about not blaming voters, but we should absolutely blame voters if we believe in the system. Blame doesn't mean you're an idiot and you're a worthless scum. That's not blaming. Blaming is holding them to account. Say, you're making decisions that are destroying your own future or your children's future. And it's important for you to be aware of this. Know what you're doing. I'm going to hold you accountable for the decision to vote for this politician, or to be okay with a war in Iraq, or to be okay with these destructive environmental or anti-immigration policies. I'm going to criticize you as a voter, as a group of voters, for doing this, because you're doing this not just in a way that is different from my, if you like, ideology on where the world should go, but it's also different from your own ambitions about where you want society to go. And holding you accountable is an important aspect of what makes liberal democracy strong. I mean, maybe he's not, you know, the right person to quote in this sense, because of course he's become more and more controversial as time goes by. But Churchill had a good point when he said, hey, the best argument against democracy is a five-minute conversation with the average voter. And that is important to be able to express, to say, hey, you voters, you're absolutely wrong with Brexit. You're absolutely wrong with extremist populism. You're destroying your own and your children's future.
And what now?
See, I mean, in the end, I mean, it's right. So we have different approaches, but we basically come to the same conclusion, right? So, I mean, I like in your scenario, we can basically hold them accountable, the voters for their individual decisions. For me, I mean, I still struggle a little bit with what does it mean to hold someone accountable, telling them off in the end. Okay, that's nice and pretty, but I'm not sure whether that will make a difference. However, the ultimate conclusion here seems to be that no matter which approach you take, you basically end up at the same conclusion, and that is that it won't make a difference, right? I mean, I'm not sure whether either way is actually going to change anyone's mind in November when voting for or against Donald Trump.
Yeah, now, listen, obviously Balder criticizing some voters in a podcast is not going to change the world. When I mean holding them to account, criticizing them, I hope that there will be a space in society more broadly that critically addresses the behavior of voters and doesn't treat them with kid gloves, right? As if they are sheep, as if they're children that cannot be taken seriously, and they're just manipulated and the victims of evil elites. Because that is, in the end, what it comes down to too quickly. If you don't hold voters responsible, if you don't criticize voters, basically your conclusion is, oh, it's all the problem of the elites. And that is exactly where things go horribly wrong. Because elites can do terrible things, but they can also do really good things if voters hold them accountable in the proper way, in the responsible way, look at them carefully. And so when you look at future models, maybe the best way to assess that is looking at past models. When did democracy work more in a more healthy, more constructive way? That's when elites were leading crowds, leading masses in the 70s, 80s, 90s, evolving, as we've discussed in the past. Those decades weren't perfect. There was institutional racism, there was institutional sexism, but you had a relatively well-functioning democratic system where most voters said, hey, you know what, I just don't know, but I trust these elites. I am letting those elites make decisions for me. Unless they become corrupt, unless they do things that go against the pillars of the system, and that's the moment that I will stop voting for them. But as long as they behave responsibly within my ethical framework, I am just going to go with what the elites tell me I should go with. And so you had left-wing elites, right-wing elites, center elites, and they would have intellectual conversations with a basic voting bloc that they could rely on. And that kept extremist policymaking out of the house. It kept society moving forward, improving its sexist tendencies, becoming less racist, becoming less patriarchal, becoming more environmentally aware. Instead of what you have now, where basically society is being torn apart, right? So the future surely must come from that kind of thinking, some kind of hybrid model where we don't just rant about elites and we protect the electorate, where we say no. Actually, let's have elites be generally responsible and being held accountable by voters who also will be held accountable. Some kind of hybrid model where elites leading the masses and the masses making sure that the elites stay honest.
This seems like a great moment to end today's conversation on individual responsibility. If you have any questions, comments, or you heard a mistake that we've made throughout the episode, please make sure to send us an email to thewesternbubble@gmail.com, and we will try to incorporate them in our following episodes. Thank you very much to the listeners for joining us today. Make sure to join us again next week when we burst the Western Bubble. That is it from my side. Balder, which closing quote did you bring for us today?
I already quoted a historically increasingly controversial figure with the name of Winston Churchill. And now I'm choosing another certainly controversial figure, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, the Soviet critic, rebel, who has since also been very critical of the West. And he said, human rights are a fine thing, but how can we make ourselves sure that our rights do not expand at the expense of the rights of others? A society with unlimited rights is incapable of standing to adversity. If we do not wish to be ruled by a coercive authority, then each of us must rein himself in.